Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
First Republic Bank fails. Can its sale to J.P. Morgan stave off a reignition of the banking crisis? Plus, chip designer Arm plans to revive its massive IPO, and we'll look at the winners and losers of the sliding U.S. dollar.
A lot of big, important companies in the U.S. have huge operations abroad, and whenever they're translating those earnings back into the U.S. dollar, if the dollar is weaker, it's going to make those overseas earnings look better.
It's Monday, May 1st. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin with breaking news, as U.S. regulators have seized troubled lender First Republic and overnight made a deal to sell the bulk of the bank's operations to J.P. Morgan Chase. The move heads off a chaotic collapse that threatened to reignite March's banking crisis, though it is nonetheless an astonishing comedown for First Republic, which is now the second largest bank to fail in U.S. history. And joining us now with the details is Wall Street Journal Deputy Europe Finance Editor Quentin Webb. Quentin, firstly, give us the details of this deal that we're just now learning about.
Hi. So the FDIC has seized First Republic and is then selling on the bulk of the business to JP Morgan. JP Morgan will assume all of First Republic's deposits, which total nearly $92 billion, and it will buy most of the bank's assets, which total more than $203 billion. There is also a loss-sharing agreement between the FDIC and JP Morgan as part of this, and the agency has estimated that its insurance fund will take a hit of about $13 billion as part of the deal. JP Morgan has also said it would receive about $50 billion in financing from the FDIC.
So, Quentin, walk us through what exactly transpired over what now appears to have been a very, very busy weekend to bring us to this point.
Right. So this is often the way with bank failures. Regulators like to get this done over a weekend so that markets can open calmly again on Monday morning. And over the weekend, there was a sale process in which JP Morgan, PNC Financial and others were in the mix with bids potentially to buy parts of First Republic.
And Quentin, this all follows quite a drop in First Republic shares in trading last week, though before that, it had been over a month since the peak of the banking turmoil. Sketch out that period for us. What brought us to this point for First Republic?
That's right. So First Republic started to come under pressure in March as part of this broader crisis among regional banks in the US. And the pressure kicked up a gear last week when First Republic disclosed that it had effectively lost about $100 billion in deposits as part of that earlier turmoil. And so through the course of last week, First Republic's share price crashed. It sold off very steeply day after day as investors started to worry about what the future of First Republic might be.
In terms of that future, what does this whole deal mean for the bank's customers?
So the bank's customers are now JP Morgan customers. First Republic bank branches are due to open on Monday morning under the ownership of JP Morgan.
And for the banking sector in the U.S. as a whole, we've now seen three of the four largest ever U.S. bank failures occurring in just the past 2 months. But also with this deal, some consolidation within the industry, right? What is the outlook there?
Actually, analysts are relatively relaxed about the outlook. There is a sense that this is contained among some of the smaller lenders. It's contained among the regional banks who are more exposed to uninsured deposits and who, following this rapid run-up in U.S. interest rates, were exposed because their assets have lost value and perhaps they're also at risk of deposit flight and having to rely on very expensive funding. Actually, you know, we've seen a sort of flight to safety in recent weeks in which the bigger banks have benefited. They have drawn in deposits and now JP Morgan is picking up the business of First Republic. Now, at this point, it's not clear to what extent they're doing something that is quote unquote national service and to what extent this will actually be a beneficial deal for them. But, yes, there is a kind of differentiation, if you like, between what's happening with the smaller banks in the US and the biggest and strongest too big to fail style banks.
That was Wall Street Journal Deputy Europe Finance Editor Quinton Webb. Quinton, thank you.
Thanks very much.
British chip designer Arm is quietly moving ahead with its long-awaited IPO. The company, which is owned by Japanese tech investor SoftBank, submitted a draft IPO registration to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission over the weekend. It's a move that Journal Tokyo Bureau Chief Peter Landers told me could be the start of one of the biggest public listings in years.
Yeah, we still don't know a number of facts about this IPO, including when it will happen and what valuation will be given to Arm. SoftBank purchased it for about $32 billion in 2016, and the semiconductor market has gone up and down and up and down since then, but certainly we could expect a valuation in that range or perhaps as high as $50 billion, figure given by some analysts.
Peter, why is SoftBank pursuing an IPO here in the first place? They had previously been looking to sell Arm, right?
That's right. At one point, they wanted to sell it to NVIDIA, but antitrust concerns ultimately scotched that, and SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son turned to this plan B, which is to list Arm in an initial public offering. And I think his motive is really to unlock the value in Arm, and that means using the money that he makes from the IPO to invest in new companies. So SoftBank used to be more of a telecommunications-oriented company, but over the last 5 years or so, it's really transformed itself into a technology investment company. And Masayoshi Son, the founder, loves nothing better than to scout out promising startups. At the moment, he's a little short on money to do so, but if he's able to sell some of Arm, that would give him the cash to move on to new ventures.
That was Wall Street Journal Tokyo Bureau Chief Peter Landers. China is taking fresh steps to cut off overseas access to information about its economy. We are exclusively reporting that access is drying up to databases belonging to Shanghai-based Wind Information Co., whose economic and financial data are widely used by analysts and investors inside and outside the country. According to interviews with researchers and analysts, many foreign entities are finding that they can't renew their subscriptions to Wind over what the company has deemed compliance issues. The increased restrictions come as Beijing embarks on a campaign to pressure Western consultants, auditors, and other providers that are used by multinationals to assess risks in China. A Wind representative told customers trying to renew their contracts to speak to their account managers, while China's State Council Information Service didn't respond to a request for comment. President Biden has called for the release of jailed Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich in Russia. Those remarks came at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, at which members of the media and government officials celebrated press freedom. Evan Gershkovich was detained in March by Russian security services and is being held on an allegation of espionage that the Journal and the U.S. government vehemently deny. In his speech, Biden called for the release of Gershkovich, as well as American journalist Austin Tice, who disappeared while reporting in Syria more than a decade ago.
Our message is this: journalism is not a crime. Evan and Austin should be released immediately, along with every other American held hostage or wrongfully detained abroad. The stress of not knowing, the sorrow of uncertainty. But I want them and their families to know, Jill and I understand, we see them. They are not forgotten. And I promise you, I am working like hell to get them home.
And looking ahead this week, today might be a quiet day for global exchanges with most markets closed, though it is set to be a busy few days on Wall Street, with the likes of Starbucks, Ford, and Apple due to report earnings, which are set to offer a closer look at consumer spending habits in a slowing economy. Wednesday's big news will be the Fed's latest interest rate decision. We're reporting that officials there are on track to increase rates yet again, but will also deliberate whether that is enough to finally hit pause on the Fed's fastest rate rising cycle in 40 years. And coming up, the U.S. dollar is off to a rough 2023. It slipped almost 9% from its peak in September, and investors are betting that it has further to fall. We'll look at the winners and losers should the dollar slide continue after the break.
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/itheroes.
The air is coming out of the U.S. dollar. After years of outperforming other foreign currencies, the greenback is currently experiencing its worst start to the year since 2018. And here to explain what is ending King Dollar's long rally and why investors think this downward trend could continue is Journal Markets reporter Chelsea Delaney. Chelsea, the dollar has been so strong for so long, it almost feels like that's just a given. What is changing now?
Well, yeah, the dollar has been on this epic rally for almost a decade now. And a big part of that was that the U.S. economy really stood out, even in these sort of post-financial crisis years where economic growth was very slow and inflation was very low. And that's all really starting to change now, which is not something we've seen in a really long time. One part of that is that the dollar is very overvalued and U.S. rates are not expected to rise anymore. And really, by the end of the year, the Fed is expected to start cutting. For the U.K. and for Europe, rates are expected to keep rising. The European economy is actually doing a lot better than expected. It's sort of made it through this energy crisis, and it's not expected to fall into recession this year. So things are looking genuinely better in the Eurozone. And you also have to look at the global picture. Global growth is actually doing much better than growth in the U.S. And a lot of that has to do with China. But that also filters through to a lot of other economies, to commodity exporters, to emerging markets. Those countries are going to get a boost from this as well. So part of that is just that the dollar has been overvalued. But part of it is certainly that the rest of the world does look better.
All right, that's better. Other things look worse, though. Who stands to really lose from the weakening of the dollar?
Yeah, when the dollar was really strong, especially last year when it did get a lot cheaper for Americans to go to Europe, and we did see that. So the dollar weakening, it could have an impact on, you know, the economy of Greece or of Spain or other sort of holiday locations as well. You have to think of importers in the U.S. who are now getting less for their dollars when they're importing things.
And in terms of the winners here, it seems maybe there's a longer list of beneficiaries of this long-awaited dollar slide.
Yeah, I mean, the dollar is so important for the rest of the world, and so many governments, so many companies borrow in dollars. And whenever, you know, the dollar is weakening, it's getting cheaper for them to repay those loans and those bonds. So it's very important for companies and governments around the world. We've seen several countries default because they can't pay back those dollar loans. So this is a big benefit for them, as well as for U.S. multinationals. Like, a lot of big important companies in the U.S. have huge operations abroad. And, you know, whenever they're translating those earnings back into the U.S. dollar, if the dollar is weaker, it's going to make those overseas earnings look better.
I have to ask, Chelsea, is it possible that sort of a weakening U.S. dollar that feeds global growth sort of feeds further dollar depreciation? It's like making these other emerging markets stronger, and then you get this growth mismatch relative to the U.S. and this cycle just kind of perpetuates.
Obviously, a weaker dollar is going to be more helpful for other global economies, and economic growth is a major driver of currency valuations a lot of times. So yeah, it could end up becoming a bit of a self-reinforcing cycle where these countries are benefiting from the weaker dollar, which makes their economy stronger, and it just sort of amplifies the attractiveness of other places versus the U.S. From speaking to investors and analysts, a lot are not seeing this as a really long-term decline for the dollar. Many still believe that, you know, we will see some dollar weakness throughout the year. It's still overvalued, maybe 10 to 15%. But at some point, economies are going to start facing the same pressures that the U.S. is now facing. And the U.S. is one of the first to really exit lockdown. So they are kind of running ahead of the cycle. And at some point, that cycle is going to catch up with other countries, too.
And even if this is a multi-year slide for the dollar, Chelsea, is there any indication this goes further than that, that we are seeing the dollar's sort of longstanding supremacy, its position as a safe haven currency, being up for question?
People love to talk about the death of the dollar. Ever since I've been covering FX currencies for like almost a decade now, this has been such a big topic. And we've seen really no evidence that that is really happening. The dollar is still the world's safe haven currency. It's still the most heavily used currency for trade. Many countries still borrow in the dollar. So it is still very much the preeminent currency. There are, of course, other currencies that are trying to edge in on that supremacy. We've seen a lot of countries discussing using the Chinese yuan for trade, borrowing in the Chinese yuan. We've seen Russia and China setting up different payment systems so that they can, you know, get around the dollar. But most people that I've spoken to, experts, investors, really don't see that as a substantial threat. We might see it lose a small amount of its position, but long term, the dollar is the most liquid currency. The dollar is the safest currency. And you have this huge economy of scale that makes it the easiest currency to use. So I think it doesn't indicate that the dollar is going to lose any of its dominance.
That was Wall Street Journal markets reporter Chelsea Delaney. Chelsea, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, drains. Ah, drains. The daily lifesavers that get waste as far away from us as fast as possible. But recently, epidemiologists and public health officials have been taking a closer look at the billions of germs and bacteria that we flush down our drains every day, which it turns out can actually tell us quite a bit.
What we can tell is what the amount is of that particular pathogen that we're measuring over time. And that tells us, are cases going up? Are cases going down? Are cases at a higher level than they were at a previous time?
That is Dr. Marlene Wolf from Emory University, who is one of the leaders of Wastewater Scan, a group that is pushing to use municipal wastewater systems to monitor diseases on a national scale. Wastewater monitoring was vital in the early detection of COVID-19, even helping to forecast some outbreaks. And Wolf says that if you're used to getting weather forecast alerts on your phone, we might one day be getting disease alerts the same way, too.
You can look at the weather, you can look at the pollen count on your phone, right? And you have some sense of, oh, yeah, I'm having bad allergies today because the pollen count is really high. And you can imagine the exact same kind of use of this data. And that's already how I use it in my personal life, right? You know, I look at our data and I say, wow, influenza season is starting. I'm going to make sure I go and get my flu shot.
To learn more about how wastewater disease monitoring is changing public health, check out our sister podcast, The Future of Everything, wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what's news for Monday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.